Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
It is not Rick Moore. This is Sean McCord, your friendly monthly substitute host on the Sunday morning wake-up call. What a bright, beautiful morning. My guest this morning is Paul Friedman. Let me get all your titles right at least once, Paul. You are the associate professor at the Department of Politics at UVA and the associate chair.
Exactly.
And I'm standing on my own mic here. So first of all, I apologize. We set this up months ago for you to come in and talk about
the election.
The election. You know, mic's on now. We set this up months ago to come in and talk about the. I thought we'd have something to talk about.
Little did we know.
Six months ago, we were in the middle of it. Things are getting interesting now. What's left?
Fizzled out. You're absolutely right.
Now we're just waiting for the balloons to drop. Okay. Obviously, none of that is true. This has turned out to be one of the craziest election seasons
absolutely.
In my memory. And you're a history professor, so your memory goes back even further than mine.
It's absolutely. I mean, it's fascinating. It's unexpected. People are thinking about it, talking about it. In fact, it's not just us. It's not just faculty. It's not just people who do this for a living. 75% of Americans tell the Gallup poll that they have given a lot of thought to the election. And that is, I should say, a dramatic increase from what we've seen in previous elections. 75%, it was only 42% in the election of 2000, which was a pretty interesting election.
I remember 2000.
Yeah.
That was kind of an interesting election. And at the time, I remember thinking, God, I hope that's the most interesting election we ever have.
Little did we know. I mean, that was an election that was, for most intents and purposes, a tie. Between the Democratic and Republican. Exactly. And what that meant was, among other things, we didn't know who the president was for about 34 days after the voting was concluded.
And little did we know that, in retrospect, what a grand 34 days that was.
Right, peace.
We had it so good.
Right. But that was historic in all sorts of ways. And I think we are witnessing an election that is significant, historic, fascinating for a whole different set of reasons.
Yeah.
And of course, one reason is that we have a likely Democratic nominee who is a woman.
What?
For the first time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's striking, and I think that with all of the sound and the fury and the Trump, it really bears noting, right, that this is as Hillary Clinton herself acknowledged, a milestone, a historic milestone. It was in the lifetime of people we know, mm-hmm. right, who that women have been able to vote in this country, right? My grandmother came to this country at a time when women did not have the franchise.
Wait a minute. I'm sorry. Your grandmother came here from another country?
Yeah, please not tell Donald Trump.
So right. That means you're biased.
Right.
You're biased,
right. Apparently I'm Polish. But it wasn't inevitable, right, that we would have a woman nominee.
No.
Right? In fact, shortly after women got the franchise in 1920, the Gallup organization in the 30s began to ask questions about whether Americans would vote for a female candidate. And in 1937, two-thirds said absolutely not. 67% said we would not vote for a woman who was, and the question was very explicit, otherwise completely qualified to serve as president, right? Well, things have changed. Now it's in the 90s.
90s wouldn't vote for
a woman. 90s who would. Good. 90s who would. So we do... All of which is to say that this already has been an election season of historic proportions.
Well, there's so much to talk about, but since we're on this topic, let's talk about Ms. Clinton, because there's been this election has just sort of I don't know sort of dug down into the mud and just kind of brought up the dark underbelly of American politics. And there's so, you know, that and being an election, being in a time when we're so embedded in social media. So everybody has an opinion, whether or not it's actually backed up by anything other than just their guts.
Mm-hmm.
So there's so much vitriol out there. Yeah, I completely agree with you. Let us not lose sight of the fact that this is a historic moment. But is Hillary Clinton the right woman to have been the first nominee?
I have no idea. She is the woman,
right,
who is the first major party nominee. And we should also note that we're talking about major party nominee.
Yes.
We should also note that there have been women in both parties who have been vice presidential.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
Whether or not Clinton is the right person, I don't know how to answer it, and I'm not sure that it matters
It was a vague question. I really wasn't asking for a personal opinion. Rather than this is sort of the question that's out there in the zeitgeist.
Sure.
I mean, people, you know, a lot of her critics, even on the left, actually, especially on the left, say, well, she's overly ambitious. She's too beholden to the establishment. She wants it too much. And I'm listening to that, I'm thinking those are not criticisms that we would put on a man.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Was it literally supposed to be like Venus in the half shell? Was it supposed to be a virgin born of the gods who we'd never heard of?
That was Bernie Sanders. No. I think you are you're absolutely right, and I think that's actually a very important point to make, that although we have this historic moment, the world hasn't changed completely fundamentally, just as the election of our first African American president certainly didn't mean that race was over as a political issue, as a contentious issue. Exactly. So no, we've got obviously a long way to go, and I would suggest that means even more that it's worth pausing and recognizing where we are, how far we've come. You're also absolutely right that this is an election season that has really stirred up passion, vitriol, anger, right? And that's been true across the board. There's an interesting asymmetry there in the following sense. If you look at the way that the candidates talked about and addressed one another, not just in the debates, not just on the stump, but specifically in their campaign advertising, on the Republican side, there was exactly the sort of negative appeals that one would expect.
Sure.
On the Democratic side, there was a curious lack of negative attacks over the airwaves.
Between the candidates.
Exactly.
And their sort of official campaigns.
Exactly. So if you really analyze, if you look closely at how they were talking about each other and what portrayals of each candidate emerged in their advertising, it was a very different story on the Democratic side than on the Republican side.
And I think that's important because I watched some of the debates. I couldn't stand to watch all of them. But I did watch some of the early Republican debates with all 24 candidates, or however many was up there. And they just kept taking swings at each other, and they were talking about like hot button social issues and, you know, trashing the Democratic candidate. I mean, it was just awful.
Right.
And then you turn around and watch the Democratic debate. And I would, as a reasonable thinking adult, I sat through the Democratic debates, even the early ones, and I thought, why can't they all be like this?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think some of the early Democratic debates got really good grades for being more substantive, focused on policy, even when they got into some serious policy disagreements. What you saw on the Republican side is what I think we're more used to seeing, and that is people making strong cases, taking swings, as you say, against one another. And to some extent, that is a function of how crowded the field was. Not quite two dozen, right? But 17.
Yeah.
We're talking about earlier elections. You'll remember 1988 when the Democratic field was derided with the term the seven dwarfs.
Yes.
The Republican field in 2016 had those seven and another 10,
yeah,
right? I mean, it was so literally crowded that, as you'll remember from just a few months ago, regularly the debates were split into two, mm-hmm. right? And some mm-hmm. people, you know, jokingly refer to the kids' table and the grown-ups' table. But that really speaks to part of what was so unusual, that you had so many people not only who got in, but who stayed in.
How much of that, and you're allowed to punt on this question. Mm. As I hear it coming out of my mouth, I'm thinking, oh, yeah, Paul's not going to want to answer this, but I'm going to ask.
I'll be the judge of that.
Because the Republican debates were so vitriolic, how much of that is because of sort of the nature of what it takes to kind of engage conservatives who you know, right. arguably may respond more from the gut, and how much of it was just because Donald Trump, and he set the stage. He was kind of the bully on the playground, and everybody else either had to stand up to him or get out of the
right.
game.
Right. Well, that's a great point, right? It's we've seen bullies before in American politics, but uh-huh. but Trump really is a bully and really is willing to say things that that others aren't willing to say. And I think to some extent this crowded field was a little paralyzed, right? We're not used to this kind of discourse and rhetoric. We're not used to people making these misogynistic statements publicly, proudly, repeatedly, mm-hmm. Making ethnocentric, racist statements boldly, loudly, repeatedly. And I think it did to some extent throw some of Trump's rivals for a loop. So they're taking swings, but in a real sense, you know, it was a swing and a miss time after time after time. Marco Rubio finally really tried to engage and to some extent get to Trump's level, and it ends up being, you know, a farce of an exchange over the size of Trump's hands, right?
Yeah, his hands.
So, you know, I think Rubio might have taken a page out of Elizabeth Warren's book, who I think has shown Hillary Clinton how one responds
to.
And you know, I think was something that over the last week people on the left were excited about was to see Hillary Clinton hitting back, hitting Trump where he lives, and mm-hmm. where he lives is to some extent the Twitterverse. Right. And so Clinton has this snarky Twitter response to Donald Trump. She just says, delete your account, right? Which I think resonates with younger people and people who are spend more time in and on social media.
Although I got to tell you, Paul, when I saw that, I had visions of, you know, 67-year-old Hillary Clinton trying to type into her search bar, delete your account, and accidentally tweeting it out.
could be, right? And this is obviously an area, a sensitive area for Secretary Clinton in terms of thinking about which accounts maybe should have been deleted, weren't deleted, where the accounts were.
Yes.
But I think what we're going to see is a struggle to balance the desire and the need to push back against Trump in strong, powerful, straightforward ways without kind of getting into descending to a Trumpian level of discourse. That's going to be something of a balancing act. And I'm suggesting that was a challenge for Trump's rivals. So really, you know, as we think about how on earth did we get here, right?
Yeah.
One, and I should say, nobody really thought this would happen.
So that's one thing I wanted to touch on. You're a professor of history,
politics, political science.
Recent
history.
Recent history. Sometimes, you know, I even as we're in the midst of this, I wonder how history is going to look at, assuming right. that we all survive the next few years. But there's a certain, I don't want to say inevitability, but there's a certain sort of historical resonance, a kind of a beauty that our first female Democratic candidate, that her opponent is going to be Donald Trump. I mean, this misogynist, racist, sort of uber macho bully who has, you know, made a career of browbeating people. This is, you know, as as a writer, I'd have almost a harder time coming up with a sort of a more delicious scenario.
Yeah,
than
Sean,
this.
You know, absolutely. In fact, if you put this in a play, people might give you notes saying maybe it's a little too precious, that we have this this contrast. No, it really is striking. You know, political scientists, as we were saying, we pay attention to history, absolutely, but we also are very fixed on the future. Mm. And one of the things that we are apt to do is to make predictions. Right. And what's really to build on what we know, to use data that we have, models of how the political world works, to make predictions about, among other things, election outcomes. And with respect to predicting this election outcome, the Republican primary, nobody saw this coming.
Right. If you and I had met a year ago, we would have been talking about Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton.
Oh. Absolutely. What were people writing a year ago or a year and a half ago? They were writing about another Bush-Clinton dynastic battle.
Right.
Right. This was the lens, the frame that we assumed would. Mm-hmm. In fact, I remember I had a conversation with a student who, a former student, she graduated and she became a journalist. We were talking about which Republican candidate she would ask to be assigned to cover. And I said, boldly and stupidly, smart money's on the big money. Go with Bush.
Yeah.
Right. Nobody imagined that that Trump would certainly that he would defeat Bush as quickly as he did, which isn't to say that Jeb Bush was without flaws. And in fact, he had some flaws that Donald Trump did an outstanding job of pointing out and exploiting.
Yes.
But look, we across the board.
I never thought I'd say this. I actually felt a little sorry for Jeb Bush.
Oh yeah. Oh, it was.
I'm surprised those words even came out of my mouth. But
nobody saw Trump actually winning this, and it's not just that we failed to predict it. It's that for the most part, political scientists. Let me just, this political scientist specifically and repeatedly said, it's not going to be Trump. Oh, don't worry. And we had all sorts of explanations, right? All sorts of reasons. One of which was, this isn't the way we think the world works.
Right.
We understand nomination contests to be, in large part, a reflection of the will of the party, what party leaders, elders, what party power brokers ultimately want to see happen, we imagined is among the most important factors in understanding the outcome of a primary election season. And that's not what happened this year. Now, part of the reason, as we were saying, was just that the field was so crowded and divided, so that the anti-Trump vote was split among 16 different candidates, many of whom did have the backing of important sectors of the Republican establishment, right? In fact, you know, what did we know? We knew that Ted Cruz really was an outsider. He really did alienate many of the most powerful people in his own party. And, you know, some of us assumed that would make things more difficult for Donald Trump, not less. In the end, it wasn't simply that it was a crowded field. It was a crowded field that was never able to winnow itself down to unite behind one voice of opposition to Donald Trump. It wasn't Chris Christie. It wasn't Marco Rubio. It wasn't Cruz in the end. And it certainly wasn't Ben Carson. Carly Fiorina. The list goes on and on, and so again, it wasn't just the sheer numbers; it was the inability to effectively make a case against Trump.
My guest who is ticking off Republican candidates like ticks off a dog is Paul Friedman, associate professor of politics at UVA and associate chair. You are listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Yes, and we probably should have had that conversation after I killed your mic, but I didn't, so.
Oops.
You can tell I only do this once a month. It is a Sunday morning wake-up call. This is your only occasional host, Sean McCord, with Paul Friedman of UVA Department of Politics. So, Paul, what only are we going to talk about?
Well, let me tell you what I want to talk about, Sean. We're talking about how we got here in terms of what happened on the Republican side. Yeah. Obviously, it was a fascinating roller coaster of a ride on the Democratic side. But at this point, although there still is voting coming up this week in the District of Columbia. And as we know, Bernie Sanders is in it, will be competing for, I think there are about 45.
Now, Bernie Sanders. Who is this Bernie Sanders of which you speak?
Hey, you have not heard the last
of or from
Bernie Sanders. He's going to be continue to play an important role in this election. And one of the reasons for that is because, as you know, Sanders supporters are committed, are enthusiastic, are engaged.
But are they Democrats?
Well, here's what they're not.
Yes.
They're not Trump voters. Right.
Sure.
The question is, will they be Clinton voters? Right. And one of the important questions over the next few weeks and months is, to what extent can Hillary Clinton successfully engage Sanders supporters and keep them focused on this election and actually turn them out to vote in November? Now, she doesn't have to do this alone. What Bernie Sanders says in the next few days and weeks about his candidates, to his supporters, about his candidacy, about Clinton, is going to be important. What Sanders and President Obama met at the White House. We don't know exactly what was said, but to the extent that Barack Obama can help transition Sanders voters into Clinton supporters, that's going to be important for really shoring up the Democratic base. Because these are, what do we know about Sanders supporters? They're younger, right? They're enthusiastic. They're energetic. Sound familiar? That's what we said about Obama voters.
Yeah. So I'm going to, here's my couple of minutes on Bernie Sanders, because I am a Sanders supporter, but I'm not a Sanders supporter to the exclusion of anybody else. Now, you may recall that he came here last spring. He had a scheduled appearance here that he had scheduled before he became a candidate, but then he announced that he was a candidate. So he was here like a week and a half, 2 weeks after he'd been announced he was a candidate. So there was a big turnout at the Trinity Church over in Preston.
Mm-hmm.
I was fortunate enough that I was actually one of the I got inside.
Yeah, you were one of the few.
I was one of the many, but there were even many more who didn't even get inside. And then I got to he mingled with the crowd afterwards, and I got to speak to him very, very briefly, just basically, go Bernie. But a friend of mine said to him, whatever you do, do not do what Hillary Clinton did in 2008, you know, and give your electors to Hillary Clinton at the party. And I mean, literally his eyes dilate. He's like, what are you talking about? That is so far in the future. And yet that's kind of where we are now, where he has, you know, he has this groundswell of people who are supporting him and what he's always been talking about. And let me go on record. I am completely for all the things that he's been talking about how, you know, the billionaire class is running our society and the banks and the financial shenanigans. But I am an atheistic, anarchist, socialist, dyed-in-the-wool lefty, and by no means do I think that I actually represent anything like a plurality of the voting public. Although I am stunned and pleased that he's gotten as far as he's gotten and as much support as he's gotten, I never for the life of me actually believed that he would be the final candidate. He's gotten much further than I would have anticipated. And I think this is where we need to have our it's going to sound funny coming from me, but our come to Jesus talk with many of his supporters is like, okay, you did great.
Right. Right.
But what you need to be now is allies rather than ranting against the establishment of the Democratic Party, who I agree have been ignoring some of these problems for too long a time. Work from within.
Right.
Become a part of the conversation rather than outside of it.
Yeah, and the conversation is one that has evolved in all sorts of ways precisely because Bernie Sanders was on the ballot,
yeah.
was contesting this nomination and did so really unexpectedly well for so long. And, so I think there's an argument that he's already changed the conversation within the party and that he will continue, particularly as we look ahead to questions like the party platform, right? The conversation that will be going on inside the party about what the priorities are, what the issues, what the stances, what the planks in the party platform will look like. And Sanders and his supporters are really in an outstanding position to have an impact on that. Now, at the end of the election, at the end of the campaign, I think that we face, well, I'll paraphrase Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld here.
Oh, yeah, Rummy.
We go into the ballot booth, the voting booth, with the candidates we have, not the candidates we wish we had.
Right,
right.
Right.
And, you know, so at that moment, right, and maybe it's not in the, we're not actually in a voting booth, but we are perhaps filling out an absentee ballot, or we are voting early as increasingly around the country, people are. We have to, you know, we don't get to make the choice we wish we could, right? Mm. We have to make the choice that confronts us. And, you know, if all plays out the way at this point it looks like it will, that choice is going to be Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump. And I think for even the most diehard Sanders supporters, people who have been engaged and participating and going to meetings and giving money and attending rallies and convincing their friends for months and months and months, at that moment, it's a no-brainer.
So my guest is Paul Friedman, associate professor of politics at UVA and associate department chair. So I'm just old enough, Paul, that my first I grew up in a political family.
Mm-hmm.
We were very engaged. My dad, I've even told this story on the air sometimes before. My dad was a young Republican, and then after Goldwater, became a Democrat and actually became involved with the local Democratic Party running campaigns, ran for office himself later on. My first early political memories are 1968.
Mm-hmm.
I was
mm-hmm.
7 years old, just old enough to remember Martin Luther King, remember Bobby Kennedy,
yep.
to remember something about the convention in Chicago, even though I wasn't entirely aware of what was going on. Are we facing another 1968? What is the Democratic Convention going to be like?
Well, if you mean mass demonstrations and violence and arrests and facing off between young people and police.
Yeah,
I don't know. Right.
But you're a prognosticator.
If I've learned nothing from this election season, it's that sometimes I don't know is the best answer, because I will tell you the number of times I told people, don't worry, the nominee will not be Donald Trump. And some of those people are listening right this moment and they know exactly what I'm talking about. And now they're wondering why you even have me on the air. Right. I will tell you that one of my colleagues who I won't name, but you might be able to, famously and boldly said a little over a year ago, Donald Trump will not be the nominee. If Donald Trump is the Republican nominee, then everything we think we know about convention, about the primary process is wrong.
And guess what?
Everything he was right.
He was right.
He was absolutely
that.
Right. And I don't know if everything we think we knew was wrong, but a whole lot that we think that we thought we knew needs to be revised. And so it was a good lesson, right? Mm. For a lot of people who think that that it's an easy business, right, to predict election outcomes. It's something that actually we perhaps were too have been too cavalier about, and I know here at UVA that's a good thing, but I mean it's something we want to avoid.
We are the Cavaliers after all,
right? So look, we're also coming. Emerging from, and it's not clear that we have emerged fully, a fairly extensive period in which relations between law enforcement and citizens have been strained, mm-hmm. to say the least. Mm-hmm. And I think that it is in the best interests of both political parties to do as much as possible to avoid the kind of convention displays that you're alluding to.
I'm also curious about the Republican convention, just because of the number of established figures who won't be there. I mean, I made jokes. I remember I was making jokes on Facebook, you know, a year ago about, you know, Jeb Bush through gritted teeth introducing their nominees, Donald Trump and Ben Carson. I thought it was a joke.
Right.
But now Jeb Bush may not be there. John McCain's not going to be there. Neither of the Bush
right.
presidents are going
right.
to be there.
But Bob Dole will be.
Bob Dole.
Well. Bob Dole made a, took a clear and strong stand in support of his party's nominee the other day. As have many party leaders, including the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, who made it clear that after really being cautious and circumspect and waiting to endorse Donald Trump, he finally did. And he has stood by that endorsement even in recent days when others, for example, Senator Mark Kirk of Illinois, Republican of Illinois, who it's essentially rescinded his endorsement in the face of Trump's comments about the judge, Gonzalo Curiel, who is presiding over the lawsuit against Trump University. And as you know, Sean, Trump has accused the judge of bias because he is, quote, Mexican.
Yes.
When in fact, he's from Indiana.
Right.
Right.
Which I don't think borders on Mexico.
I don't think so. I think maybe Trump can see Mexico from Indiana, but it's not. He made comments of about Judge Curiel that have been really rejected by almost everybody. In fact, majorities of Americans, strong majorities of Democrats, and pluralities of independents see the comments not only as wrong, right? Again, suggesting that a judge is inherently biased against Donald Trump because the judge is Mexican American, mm-hmm. right? And what's interesting here is that Trump's logic is that he has so offended Mexican Americans and Mexicans that no Mexican American could ever be unbiased in judging him. That's fascinating right there.
And he later followed that up later on saying, you know, it would be the same thing if it was a Muslim judge or I assume a female judge.
He didn't say that, but he did say, you're absolutely right. He was asked by John Dickerson on Face the Nation, would you have the same feeling that a Muslim judge was not able to be unbiased in a case against you? And he said yes, right? Acknowledging the extent to which he has alienated Muslims and Mexicans.
And I think Paul Ryan, just watching, just trying to imagine his internal struggle. I mean, not for the first time I've asked, how do you sleep at night? But to see him get on TV, you know, and in the one hand say, I will support the Republican nominee, and on the other hand, calls Trump's statements, you know, a textbook example of racism, which
exactly.
must have been really hard for him because we all know how Republicans feel about textbooks.
Exactly. But you're right. He said, and then that was a quote, a textbook definition of a racist comment.
Right.
Paul Ryan says this about Trump's comment publicly, right? And then in the next breath,
yes,
stands by his endorsement. He says he called the comments completely unacceptable. And he goes on to say, but I don't believe Hillary Clinton is the answer. Paul Ryan, in that statement, said the Republican nominee has made textbook examples of racist statements, and I support him.
Right.
That's a difficult position to maintain as Speaker of the House, unless you simply don't care that you are endorsing somebody you have called a racist.
Well, except he didn't. And I thought the party
his comments
were racist.
Right.
And this, but this is going to be, because let's face it, Donald Trump is not going to back off. He's not going to suddenly no longer be Donald Trump.
Right.
This is going to be what it's like at the convention, watching whoever they get to come up there and trot out and endorse him. That line, whether visible or not, is going to have to be there.
Right. So once we get past the conventions, right, here's part of the electoral landscape that Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton will both face.
I see you brought in some maps.
I brought in some maps and charts.
Hold this up to the microphone.
I brought in all these great maps, although my printer has run out of color ink, and so the entire country is red.
That's red and pink. That's really frightening, Paul. You made my heart skip a beat there. We're talking to Paul Friedman, associate professor of politics at UVA and associate chair. Let's take just a quick break.
Okay, great.
I'll kill your microphone this time, and then we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, heating oil and propane for your home or business, and the award-winning Markets of Tiger Fuel, with 6 area locations.
All right, Mike's back on. Maps and charts in hand. Hold them up in the microphone.
You like that? So, in terms of the changing landscape of the American electorate, right? This is what the candidates will confront, and it's a landscape that has, although there's some debate over the composition of the white electorate, for example, one thing that we do know is that the electorate has gotten less white over the last couple of decades.
What does that mean?
Okay, so in 2000, mm-hmm. right, the election that we were talking about earlier.
Remember that?
78% of the electorate was non-Hispanic white. About 12%.
Now, does that mean, by the election, you mean registered voters are people who actually voted?
These are eligible voters.
Okay.
Right? So
okay.
This is the pool, got right, it. From which the electorate can be drawn.
Right.
Right?
Got it.
So we go from an eligible electorate of that is 78% non-Hispanic white, 7% Hispanic in 2000. That comes down to an estimated, for this fall, 69% non-Hispanic white and 12% Hispanic. Now, going from 78% to 69%, that might not seem like a dramatic change. Politically, it is.
Sure.
Right. Politically, it is. And an electorate that is more Hispanic, more African-American in 2016 than it was even in 2012 and 2008 means a greater challenge for Donald Trump.
Now, I remember in 2012 when the Republicans were stunned that Mitt Romney didn't win the election, and they had the sort of the post election examinations, and they said, we need to broaden our mm-hmm. party. We need to appeal. We need to appeal to Hispanics. We need to appeal to minorities. And they said things like, Hispanic immigrants are natural Republicans. If we just talk about the issues that are important to us about small government and helping small business and helping communities.
More religious, culturally conservative. You're mm-hmm. absolutely right. Republicans for a long time have seen the Latino electorate as one that should be, if not ripe for the Republican picking, at least more likely to vote for Republican candidates than it has been.
Like Marco Rubio.
Exactly. Well, we had Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz mm-hmm. in the race on the Republican side this year.
And Spanish-speaking Jeb Bush.
Exactly.
Teb.
Exactly. Now.
So what happened?
Republican candidates since 2004 have been making an effort to reach out to Latino voters mm-hmm. With inconsistent at best, inconsistent success. What we know this year is that those efforts will be even less successful, right, with a candidate at the top of the ticket who is so openly hostile, not only to immigrants, right, not only to Mexicans, but clearly, as we've seen in recent days, to Mexican-Americans.
I mean, that was his literally his opening salvo.
Yeah.
He came down that golden escalator and started bloviating about Mexican rapists right. and building a wall.
You're absolutely right. That golden escalator in Trump Plaza, I think he descended to Neil Young's Rockin' in the Free World.
Yes.
To the consternation of Mr.
Young. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you're right. That was his opening salvo, and he has stuck by it. And a lot of analysis has focused on the need for Donald Trump to, as they put it, pivot from his firebrand rhetoric of the Republican primary to a more moderate, modulated tone as we head into the general election. And I think that in part is why so many people were so surprised by these comments about Judge Curiel, about a hypothetical Muslim judge. It seemed like he did not get the memo about pivoting towards the general election. He tried to back off a little bit.
He did. I missed it.
It was a he made some mildly conciliatory comments after Speaker Ryan and others are condemned what he had said. The other thing he did, and this was kind of interesting, he did something that he said he would never do. He gave a speech in front of a teleprompter.
What?
Yes.
What? No. Come on. No serious political candidate ever uses a teleprompter.
Well, if you had listened to Donald Trump of a few months ago, that's exactly what you would have thought. I think it was, in part, the very fact of the teleprompter was a concession and a signal. Right? And it was a wink and a nod and a suggestion to those in the party who are understandably concerned about the kind of campaign he's going to run and the kind of candidate that he will be, that in fact he can dial it back, rein it in, and pull off this pivot. But that remains to be seen.
So, Paul, my guest, Paul Friedman, from Department of UVA, excuse me, Department of Politics at UVA, on 94.7 WPVC. So is the problem... This is a broad question. I apologize ahead of time. Is the problem the Republican Party having Donald Trump, or is the problem they're having Trump supporters?
Yeah, that's a great question. And
Thank you.
It's absolutely the case that Donald Trump is a challenge for the party's prospects in November, right? We look at the numbers. Hillary Clinton's about ahead in, on average, 4 or 5 points. Now, that's at the very beginning. That gap has narrowed. In fact, at the after Trump wrapped things up in terms of getting enough delegates on the Republican side, he was actually ahead of Clinton in these polls. And as a Sanders supporter, you know that some of those polls at the time were showing that Sanders was doing better against Trump than was Clinton.
Yeah, but those polls are meaningless.
If not meaningless, at least to be taken with a grain of salt.
Sure,
right?
Okay.
In part, to be taken with a grain of salt because, as we were discussing earlier, the Democratic primary never really got into the mud, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, of all of the ads that were broadcast, as I mentioned a little while ago, basically, none of them were negative attacks. Were Sanders to be the nominee, right, he would face a very different opponent in Donald Trump than he would have than he did in Hillary Clinton.
Absolutely. Yeah. And as much as I love Bernie Sanders, I never really thought that the American public broadly was ready to support a Democratic socialist, because socialists become a
right.
terrible word the past few years, non-Christian, and, you know, someone who would be 75 years old at the time of swearing in.
So there would have been, so you're absolutely right to have been skeptical about polls showing Sanders doing better against Trump than Clinton. Clinton is now, again, arguably ahead by a few points for whatever that is worth, but the fun's just beginning, right? Mm-hmm. We will see what happens as this campaign plays out. And one of the advantages that Clinton has, certainly she's got the demographic advantages that we were just talking about, sure, in terms of an electorate that, even if it is still a strong majority white, is less white than it has been in the past. I should note, though, that although white voters are supportive of Trump, there is an important gender gap and an important education gap. White men support Trump. Strong majorities of white men support Trump.
I should say this: we're two white guys sitting here talking to each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we can say this.
So, this is a Washington Post ABC News poll from the end of May. 69% of white men supported Trump in that poll, mm-hmm, over Clinton. Only 22% supported Clinton, 22% of white men. But among white women, 47 Trump, 43 Clinton. That's a huge gender gap. And it's a gender gap that is far larger than what we saw with respect to men and women in 2012 or 2008. With respect to education, what we see is that non-college educated white voters support Trump. Two-thirds of them support Trump. 65%, only 25% of non-college educated white support Trump.
And we all know Trump loves the non-educated.
He does. He loves the non-educated. But among whites with a college degree or more, it's 46 Trump, 45 Clinton. Yeah. So let me boil this down. Among whites, there's a gender gap and there's an education gap. White men are disproportionately supportive of Trump over Clinton. White women are split. Among those without a college education, 65% support Trump. Mm-hmm. But those with a college education or above, it's split. And so what we're going to see is an election that is fought not just among different demographic, racial, ethnic groups, not just among gender groups, but among different educational groups as well. Whether or not Hillary Clinton is able to mobilize the bases of support that Barack Obama was able to engage in 2012 and especially in 2008 will determine what happens on Election Day.
So you mentioned a name I don't think we've actually mentioned yet in the past hour, and that was our president, Barack Obama.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, in 2008, in addition to running a brilliant campaign, once he got the nomination, he did a couple of really, really smart things. One of them was selecting Joe Biden as his running mate. Joe Biden, who is sort of the hero of the working class, longtime senator, sort of showed people that, one of the criticisms of Obama was that he didn't have enough experience, that he went somehow straight from community organizer to the White House. And so he brings in someone who's got a lot of experience, mm-hmm, in the Senate and the Washington scene. And he also brought in his rival, and I say that in quotes, Hillary Clinton,
yep,
to serve,
yep,
as a Secretary of State. So I realize that you're in the interest of you're a political scientist. You don't give advice to candidates, but sort of from a political science point of view, how could Donald Trump, who could he sort of bring in at his side,
right,
to kind of build up,
right,
his base among the Republican establishment?
Well, for Donald Trump, it's very difficult to say, right? One thing that's hard
would want to run with him.
Well, I think there are many. You know, somebody who's been mentioned regularly is Newt Gingrich. There's controversy in political science about how much a vice presidential pick matters. For a long time, we've assumed that it matters for the state,
sure,
from which the candidate comes, the vice presidential candidate. I think honestly, Trump, it's hard to imagine him sharing anything, right, let alone the stage, the ticket, and it's hard to imagine him being comfortable with anybody who could possibly upstage him.
Right.
And so I wouldn't be surprised if we see somebody who's a little less colorful mm-hmm. than Newt Gingrich.
So not a Christie or a...
You know, I think Christie may hope that it's Christie, and maybe it will be a Christie. That would certainly be a fun ticket.
They'd wrap up the New York, New Jersey.
Yeah, they'd have the tri-state area nailed down. Except that really remains to be seen because Trump there is going up against a former senator from the state of New York,
right? Who is apparently in the pocket of Wall Street.
So you've got that too, right? And which is always will be interesting to see how Donald Trump criticizes somebody for taking money from rich people. The other thing to think about in terms of the president is what role he will play and the extent to which he is able to really energize, engage, and mobilize voters. And I'll say here, it's significant that President Obama has an approval rating of above 50%. He is, at this point in his presidency, about as popular as Ronald Reagan was at a similar point in mm-hmm. the Reagan mm-hmm. Presidency. Barack Obama is much more popular than was George W. Bush at this time, in June of 2008.
Oh, yeah.
John McCain ran away from President Bush. It's looking like Hillary Clinton will not be running away from Barack Obama.
Oh, no, she's going to pivot.
And that he will be in a position to really engage and mobilize and get Americans excited about or Democratic Americans excited about a Clinton campaign. And that's what's going to be really critical, right? Campaigns are about mobilizing one's base and then expanding that base. And at this point, it looks like Clinton will have some real advantages on both of those fronts. But Donald Trump, it needs to be emphasized, has a core of enthusiastic, passionate, angry, and engaged supporters.
As does Bernie Sanders.
As does Bernie Sanders, absolutely.
So how are Clinton and Obama, Ms. Clinton and President Obama, going to handle... I mean, they've had some public disagreements about things. The TPP comes to mind. When he's going to be out there campaigning for her, and yet she has publicly said that she disagrees with the final sort of agreement there. How do they thread that needle?
Well, I think it's a pretty big needle hole in the sense that there's lots of other things to talk about, right, than the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Do they just not talk about it?
Okay. Right? I mean, there's a lot that the president can put into a stump speech that doesn't touch upon those areas of disagreement, right?
Okay. So, Paul, we spent 55 minutes talking about one topic, but obviously there's a lot more here we could talk about. But let's pivot.
There you go.
I was waiting to use that word appropriately because you also, you're teaching classes this summer.
Well, I just finished a class, at a course that I've been teaching for about the last 5 years on the politics of food.
Yeah, I wanted to get to that. We could spend another hour talking about it.
Right. There's probably another show coming in, but we can. This is also something that we can pick up later. I think, though, that this is a class I love teaching because it is it's an issue that politically mm-hmm. is about as important as anything I can think of, right? Food, the politics of food, how we structure and run our food system is something that affects every single one of us, right? We cannot pay attention to it, but we're all engaging with the food system multiple times a day. We're making choices about what to buy, what to eat, what not to eat. There is an entire system, an infrastructure, right? That is economic. That is political. There are decisions made by people in Washington, people in California, people all around the world that have an impact on what we can eat, what we do eat. And my objective is to try to understand that, try to unpack those decisions, and really turn people into more conscious, not just eaters, but what I would call food citizens. Hmm. And, you know, this is the Charlottesville area is a place where there are a lot of people thinking very carefully about what food citizenship entails and what it means to have a food system that is equitable, that provides access to not just a food products to consume, but healthy, nutritious food, including food that's grown around here. We live in an incredibly rich agricultural area. And, you know, so in terms of the politics of food, we want to ask, how do we make that agricultural bounty accessible to everybody?
So what do you have your class just finished? What did you have your students doing? We've got another minute or two. You said you took them out to a farm?
Well, I should say there's a class that I've taught in different venues at different places, and it's not a class. I'm not a farmer. I'm from New York. We didn't have nature when I was growing up, but we did have food and we did have politics.
Right.
And so, you know, in that sense, I come by the topic, honestly. But I've learned a lot in studying, the politics of the food system. And you're absolutely right. One of the most effective ways to learn about food and to learn about food politics is to plant a garden,
yeah,
right? And to get onto a farm, to literally get your hands dirty in the subject matter. And, you know, this is something, as you know, in
so
the city
there,
of...
Are there red vegetables and blue vegetables?
Yeah, absolutely. And next time I will tell you whether asparagus is Republican or Democratic.
Wow. Yeah, we only have a few seconds left. So, Paul, thank you so much for coming in. My
Sean, it's been a pleasure.
It really has, and we could have gone on this for a while. I hope that our listeners enjoy this. I hope we'll get this on SevillePodcast.com.
Fantastic.
Get people listening in. This is WPVC 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. My guest has been Paul Friedman from the UVA Department of Politics. This is Sean McCord, and we will see you again.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.